Welcome to the GP Soccer Podcast World Cup Show with your host, Giovanni Puccini. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the GP Soccer Podcast World Cup Show. What is this? World Cup Show number three with my wonderful panelists, Rob Ellis, Paul Robinson, Renato Capobianco, and Marcus Walfordson. We get together each week and talk about all things World Cup. And we're getting serious now, aren't we? We're out of the group stage. We're into the round of 16s. We're now looking at the quarterfinals. Teams of are winning, moving on, and by association, teams are losing and falling by the wayside. More and more intriguing stories, that have taken place, and certainly intriguing stories yet to come as I look forward. We'll talk a little bit about England, France. That's certainly going to be an intriguing story. The Netherlands, Argentina will be another intriguing story. So we have lots and lots to chat about today. So welcome to my wonderful panel. And here's where I'd like to start. We'll go back a little bit before we kind of move to where we're up today. Upsets. Now, we've seen a number of upsets here in the World Cup from the very, very, very beginning. And we could talk about each and every one of them and spend a whole show on them. But I want to focus on one team, one country in particular, because for me, certainly, they have been a bit intriguing. And I thought they were going to kind of pull it off today, that being Japan. As you all know, they were world beaters. They took down Germany. They took down Spain, both by 2-1 scores. So your thoughts on Japan in particular and how they played and how they, situated themselves relative to playing arguably two of the best teams, best countries in the world, teams and countries that come in with great history. And yet they take them on, they take them down to the point where they were able to get out of the group and advance. So, Rado, I'm going to start with you because you and I coach together. You and I are, we share our coaching minds oftentimes. Your thoughts on, Japan, Germany, Japan, Spain in particular. I know you have some strong opinions about Spain, and I want you to share that with the audience. What were your thoughts about this particular special upset team / country, that being Japan?
I would have liked to have seen them through. I think it would have been good for world football. I remember the commentator making a very interesting comment about, I think 19 of their players on their roster do not play in the J League, which kind of shows you, how far that country has come in terms of placing players all over the world. And let's be honest, that's the reality of your national team. A lot of times your national team, the success of your national team is a reflection on how many of your players are playing in the world's best leagues. And obviously that was a reflection of what Japan was able to do. I would have liked to have seen them gone through today. I think it was great. Whatever tactics that coach thought of obviously worked very well against Germany. They got a little bit lucky against Spain. I mean, you score two goals in the first 5 minutes. Having said that, I think Spain is always susceptible to a very organized high press. And that's what Japan did in that game. I wish, as much as I love Luka Modric, I would have loved to have seen Japan gone through. But that's the nature of the knockout stage.
Listen, the Croatian goalkeeper today was nothing short of magnificent. Stop three. And when you... If you stop one, as you all know, that can turn the tide in penalties, but he stopped three today. Paul, what are your thoughts on Japan, the upset specialist, it seems?
Well, I've not seen too much of him throughout the tournament, but, I am aware of the upsets in the group stage and then completely missed the game today because of work. So I saw a little bits of highlights and just before I've come on this podcast, but like nothing in depth about them. But yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head when you're saying upset specialists. And I think part of it like part of like the sort of in air quotes advantage that they have is that in terms of getting these upsets is people tend not to look that far afield at the football teams or rate them too highly. And we seem to have, especially in England, a very sort of Eurocentric outlook on football. So like the European teams are good and Southern American teams historically are great. And we rate them and we look at them as being a little bit exotic and having skillful players that we don't possess. Like we play a different style of football, but we don't look outside of that. You know, we don't look into the African teams that much. We don't look at the Asian teams or like Australasian teams or anywhere like that. So when you're not really looking that far afield and you sort of look at the rankings and you think, oh, well, you know, this team sits here and that team sits there and I recognise these players, I don't recognise them. So on paper, this team's better than that team. And then we get surprised when one of these teams that we think are sort of less capable are actually really good. And ultimately, like, it's a game of football. So, you know, players are going into there maybe thinking this game's going to be a bit easier than what it is, just based maybe like reading too much into the hype that's already around it and maybe the expectation that exists within their own country. Maybe don't turn up as much or like not playing at 100% intensity. And then for the other team, in this case, Japan, wanting to prove themselves and playing the game like it's their cup final, you know, it's a big stage for them, play out of the skin, perhaps. And, you know, you end up with an upset. And right. You see it all the time in cup football, like, you know, in England, we've got the FA Cup and you've got like tier four teams beating Premier League teams on occasion. And it's just one of those things where anyone can beat anyone in 90 minutes. But the fact that we've done it consistently, you know, beat several teams and played really well, shows you it's maybe not just them playing out of the skin, doing really well on a one-off, but they are actually that good and we've just not really recognised it or gave them that credit up until now.
Rob, what do you think?
I mean, Japan are another team I've got a sort of vested interest in here in London. I work very closely with a Japanese player program, and I have done for the last 2 years, where they send players over mainly from Tokyo, and I help them find non-league semi-professional clubs. I do individual training with them. I do group coaching. So I've, you know, I know the Japanese team quite well. You know, when you look at their list of players, it might not jump out to everyone. But I mean, for example, there's three Japanese guys playing for Celtic and doing incredibly well. Only one of them made the squad. Now, people could say the Scottish League is not the best, but if you're playing for Celtic, you're a good player, in my opinion. And the guy up front, Maeda, is the only one who's made it. Their best player, Kyogo Furuhashi, who scores goals left, right and centre for Celtic, didn't even make the squad. You've got Minamino, who's on the bench, who's played for Liverpool. You've got Tomiyasu, who is arguably Arsenal's best defender. You've got Yoshida, who's played in Germany, who's played in Italy. And the list goes on and on and on. And what was really interesting is I had a conversation with one of the Japanese coaches recently. And I've been setting up a friendly between one of his Japanese teams and one of Chelsea's junior teams, one of their development center teams. And I politely said to him, how do you think, you know, the Japanese boys will fare against the Chelsea Development Centre? These are not academy players at Chelsea, the Development Centre. So a couple of steps from. And he said, oh, they're better. And I thought he was going to be very humble. He said, you know, the Japanese boys will be technically better. He said, if you go to the J League academies, the boys will be better than the European boys. And I'm not surprised at that. I see some of the Japanese players very, very technically gifted, but I still think there may be a slight inferiority complex when they play in European, African teams, North American, South American teams. I think there's a slight mental hurdle they need to get over in terms of belief. Now, you might not think from looking at their results, they will 100% try and win the games. And they beat Germany, they beat Spain. They matched up well against Croatia. But I think there is a slight mental side to it. And there's also a slight physical. And a lot of the Japanese guys I coach, by their own admission, have said playing European football, the biggest thing they worry about is the physical side of it. These are their words. This is not a lazy, race-based stereotype. Whenever I work with the players, they have always said, we find the power side of the game a bit difficult. Now, when I looked at the Japanese team in the World Cup, I didn't necessarily see that. I saw them physically match teams, but I'm yet to see Japan physically dominate a team. And there's a difference between matching and dominating. You can't continue to match. Eventually, you need players that can dominate. And so I think Japan, I heard recently their plan is to win the World Cup by 2050, which is typically humble. But I don't know about World Cup winners, but I think they're a very, very good Japan team. Japan. I was so disappointed they went out.
We all know that they'll never be confused with a possession team. They're not Spain. They're not Brazil. And statistically, they were just behind Costa Rica in terms of the average amount of time they had possession of the ball, which was only 31.8% of the time.
Mm.
Because for the most part, they chose to sit. I mean, we saw against Spain, they sat in a 5-4-1. They didn't sit deep. They didn't park the bus, but they sat a little bit and they let Spain do their thing. Yeah. And they found a way, despite not having the ball almost 70% of the time, to be effective. Oftentimes, and Renato and I, not too long ago, had a little bit of a great conversation about this. A team like Spain who can ping, 800, 900 times in a match, 1,000 times in a match sometimes. And then you look at another team like, well, we'll talk about Japan, who are not built that way. And they're built more, will defend and will counter. Each of which has their pros and their cons and their effectiveness. We oftentimes think, as you all know, that, the best teams in the world are the ones who play the sexiest. Spain, Brazil, they bing, 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 bing. Well, you know what? It may not be as sexy, but it can be equally as effective by playing a quality defense. And Japan has shown that. Marcus, what are your thoughts before we move on?
So I think my first thought is that I don't really think they were an upset. Like, I think they've been building towards this for quite some time. Do I think they would beat both Spain and Germany? I did not. So that was a surprise, obviously. Did I think they would lose to Costa Rica? I did not. That was also a surprise. I did talk to people before this and said that, hey, I see Japan being able to go through the group, but I don't know who of Germany and Spain will go out. That was the difficult part for me. I think the way they press, and they've been working on this for years now. You see the same lines tactically and how they press and the tempo growing and improving all the time from, I think I did 10 years now. Tactically solid. I think the Spain game is interesting because when I looked at that game, I saw a team that in the first half waited to find out what was going on in the other game. And then when they started the second half, then they did what I expected them to do, mainly pressed them really, really high. And of course, they got maybe a little bit lucky to get two goals out of that. But still, there was no, for me at least, no shock about that. And I concur to the earlier speakers. You guys know what you're talking about. And I also wanted them to go through, even though I love Croatia and, I've been to Split and I've been to Hajduk and, all that good stuff. And, I love Modric and the other guys, but, if you miss three penalty kicks, you're not going to win. It's pretty simple. It wasn't the best penalty kicks in the world. So I think Rob's onto something in terms of the whole thinking they are a little bit inferior somewhere still. And I do think they will get through it. So it will be an interesting team to see next World Cup. When we come over here to see how they deal with that, I think they will be really, really dangerous.
I often talk about coaching pragmatically. And that means just doing what is appropriate to get a result. And we're talking about pragmatism here. You know what you've got, you know what you're up against. So subsequently you formulate, your formation, your system, your game plan, specific to that particular day's opponent. And Japan has done a superb job with that. You know, Rob, to your point, you talked about, you know, the size issue or athleticism. Believe it or not, that's an issue here in the United States. And it boils down to a very simple area. Our best athletes here in the United States do not play soccer. The best athletes do not play soccer. You know, we're a different sporting beast than any country, arguably around the world, particularly in Europe, where it's football or soccer, and then there's everything else. Well, here you get football, basketball, baseball, hockey. Heck, I'll throw in lacrosse as well. That's albeit a kind of a niche sport a little bit, but it's still very, very popular. And our best athletes are playing those quote unquote major sports. And that's not to say we don't have some good athletes playing soccer. We do, but we don't have a LeBron James that's playing soccer. You know, we don't have that type of athlete. And does that affect our ability to be a more effective and a higher level international squad? I say yes. I say yes. You can have all the skill in the world, but if you don't have, you know, athleticism, be a little bit bigger, stronger, faster, you know, that's going to affect you on the world stage. I look at England. Look at the size of those guys. You know, these are big, strong athletes. Big, strong athletes. Yeah, and you combine that with amazing skill. It's tough to beat.
I mean, I'm just sort of thinking, I guess in Japan, I mean, I don't know Japanese culture that well, but I mean, it seems like probably the biggest hurdle to even bigger. And I think participation in Japan is massive. I think it's a real career. I guess still the national sport is baseball. So I don't know maybe if the most talented boys and girls would still pick baseball first. I don't know. I mean, in America, you've got a bigger problem because your sports are huge. They're so popular. They're so well established. I think in Japan, I think they compete in most sports. They'll do well in the Olympics. I think tennis is quite popular, but not in the sense that within the United States, football is 100% still below, as you say, ice hockey, basketball, baseball, what we call American football. And as you say, lacrosse is maybe coming at number 6. And then you've got all your Olympic sports as well. I don't think Japan quite have so many, but maybe their best boys and girls will still go into other sports.
Yes, indeed. It is a challenge. So let's kind of move on. The focus of our weekly meetings, our weekly analysis has been around the U.S. men's national team. Before we talk about the match against the Netherlands, we got to talk a little bit about Iran. I want to first start with the predictions. The predictions, of which only two of us were spot on, myself and Marcus, right? So we both won a nickel. Rob, you had a 1-1 tie. Marcus, again, had the 2-1 USA victory. Renato had a 0-0 tie. Paul had been 0-0. And yours truly thought it would be a goal-scoring barrage with a 3-0 USA victory. They got through. I'll kind of set the table here a little bit. We saw against Iran two U.S. sides, if you will. We saw in the first half a team that could play, the team that could move the ball around and probe and penetrate and be technical and be creative. And then in the second half, we saw a team that can grind. That you know, as the clock ticked down, they could grind and they could fight, which is a wonderful combination, a nice combination to have. And subsequently, that grind, that fight, produced, well, a grinding, fighting finish, that being Christian Pulisic, just kind of throwing his body toward the goal and getting a foot on it and scoring and, you know, paying a price physically. So, you know, what are your thoughts, guys, with U.S. Iran before we kind of dive into U.S. Netherlands? Paul, we'll start with you and work our way around from there.
So that game was played at the same time as the England game. So naturally, I watched all of the England game.
Well, wait a minute here. Come on now. Go ahead.
Then, you know, I was getting the like live feed coming through to, you know, get what the scores and keeping up to date with that in real time. And then, you know, naturally, you watch your highlights after the game. You know, not quite the same as watching a full game to get the full ebb and flow and to sort of visualize the tactics at play. There's not much I can really add to your assessment.
That's okay. I understand fully. You know, if the United States is on and England's play, I know where your heart is. That's not a problem. Marcus, what were your thoughts on the match, US Iran?
Well, I'm very happy about Rob laying out how the match was going to go, because he was right, of course. So well done, Rob. And I piggybacked of you. I thought it was relatively expected. I predicted a one-goal win. I'm a little bit sad I didn't pick 1-0, obviously. Still happy, though. But I think you saw what we've been talking about all over this, where, the quality up front isn't quite there. Struggling to score. Tactically, pretty solid. Could it have been worse at the end? Sure, it could have. But we were able to see through, and I think that's a good quality. I think it talks to the quality of the players, and it's a young squad, it's a young roster, and they are learning. And seeing a 1-0 win out at the last game when you have to win, that is an accomplishment, regardless of how it looks. And then I think we can talk about the problematic parts of all this in the context of the next game. Because I think the problematic points are showed up very well against Netherlands. But that's my general thing. I think it was a good performance in general. The game was relatively as we expected. A one-goal win in a game when you have to win is always a good thing.
Renato, my friend, what have you got?
I have nothing but positives to say about the U.S. In terms of, I think they played very entertaining football. For the most part, I thought they played very smart. I do think that they unnecessarily grinded the last 20 minutes, and I'm going to lay the blame on Berhalter, because I think two subs, one that happened and one that didn't happen, Janusz Musa was dead on his feet the last 20 minutes. I mean, he had no business being on the field. That's where you think, okay, could have a Gio Reyna helped you there? Maintain possession. I mean, literally, Janusz Musa looked like one of us the last 20 minutes of that game, if you were to put us on that field. I think the substitution at right back backfired on him. So you were playing almost a man and a half down against a team that was very motivated to score. So I think that game got unnecessarily uncomfortable because of the subs. And look, as a coach, sometimes they don't work out. I get that. But there was a perfect example where I think having a Gio Reyna would have helped the United States. Having said that, I think there's a couple great takeaways. I mean, you can see some players that I'm excited to see play for the next 3 years, whether it's Robinson, whether it's I think Matt Turner showed that he's a legitimate goalkeeper. There's a lot of pluses to take away from the United States. And look, they got out of the group stage. Mexico didn't. Germany didn't. Uruguay didn't. So as much as we'd love to say you have to do this perfectly and beautifully and mistake free, the reality of the matter is you just need to get out. And I think they did that. And in the process, most of the time, they played very good football.
Rob, my friend, what have you got? What do you think?
Well, I had a different experience to Paul. I mean, I mentioned before my partner, she's Iranian. So I'm going to please all the American people out there. I watched most of the US-Iran game, partly because the first half of the England game I found so boring. I also thought that England would beat Wales comfortably, which they did. USA-Iran just felt like it had a lot more riding on it. It felt a little bit, there was jeopardy there. Before the game, as I said, I wasn't sure who would win. I wasn't sure. USA 100% deserved to win on the night, in my opinion. They were the better team. But I think, it's a game that if you play it again, Iran are in with a shout. So I thought it was a good game to watch. I think USA could have been out of sight by halftime. I was watching it with my partner's sympathies. So when USA went 1-0 up, she said, "I don't want to watch it anymore." So I was kind of watching it from her perspective, and it felt like USA were going to score a lot of goals by halftime. That was my instinct. The moment they went in 1-0, I was thinking Iran are probably going to be quite happy with this because they defend very deep, but they kind of draw a line. They'll defend the 18-yard box. The central midfielders will drop in. They almost have a line of six or seven. They're very physical defenders, and there comes a point where they will just charge at the ball. And there's not much messing about sometimes. They'll try and get it wide, long, and hit USA on the counter. And as the game became more stretched, I thought Iran were going to equalize. I thought eventually the ball's going to drop in the right place. And there are a couple of hairy moments for US. But overall, they were the better team. They were the better team. I thought Pulisic was really, really good. I thought the goal was very smart because I think the longer you hold on to the ball against Iran, they're like a brick wall moving side to side. It was all one touch. So the moment the Iranian almost back six moved up 10 yards, Adams went one ball diagonally over the top into the space, Dest one touch across, and then Pulisic. And I think that was the smartest way because if you let the Iranian defense settle, they really defend with their lives. And I think USA, although they were on top, I think they did well to get a lead at halftime. And they deserved it. They did deserve it. And like all the guys are saying, they impressed me. You know, before the tournament, as a sort of lazy minded Englishman, everyone was thinking, well, we'll go through first, you know, which is probably slightly lazy. But honestly, I know Wales quite well. I follow Iran a bit. I did not know who else was going to go through. I think it was a really tough call. Wales fell off a cliff, really. Iran had a nightmare start. But I think USA did very well. It's not an easy group to come out of that because I think you've got one clear favourite and then three quite evenly matched teams. And they were definitely better than Iran and Wales over the course of the group.
You know, I like to do, as I noted before, the deep dive. I'm an analytics kind of person. Data, I love data. And, you know, FIFA being FIFA, you know, after a match, after about 4 or 5 hours, they have all the information up. And these are 30, 40, 50 page analyses of a match. Now, I'm a junkie, but you know, I get to page 10. I'm like, okay, enough. But there's enough information for me to kind of do a deeper dive relative to, you know, was one team better than the other? We always look at one bit of data. That's the score. But we all know there's more to the score when you dive a little bit deeper. You know, some of the important things that I think, you know, indicated the United States were the better team. You know, obviously more shots on goal, far more total passes than Iran and completions. They had an 88% completion rate, which is great. When you get close to 90, that's pretty good. You know, line breaks. That's a big thing now in modern soccer, breaking lines. They did it 108 times versus Iran's 85. You know, receptions in the final third, 117 times getting the ball into the final third. I'm not going to go through each one of these. 22 crosses to Iran's 18. You know, forced turnovers. The United States was able to force the ball over 74 times. When you look into, when you do a deeper dive statistically, the predominance of advantages or wins, if you will, goes to the United States. And then you can kind of look back and at the game if you choose to do so. If you're a nerd like me, knowing this information, like, oh yeah, I saw that. Oh, I didn't know that. You know, but now with the statistics, I can now readily see that. So the United States, putting the score aside, you look at the deep dive into the numbers here, did a pretty fine job against Iran. So they got through. We all know they got through. And now, you know, it's Clockwork Orange time. It's the Netherlands. It's Holland. It's the ghost of Johan Cruyff. It's the Netherlands. And we all know how that turned out. I will set the table. And it's a very simple set the table. The United States lost on basic soccer 101. Track your runners and mark your man. When you look back at each one of those three goals, cutback balls, mark your runners, and in the last goal, wide open, could have read a book and finish. I'll get into some of the statistics there, which might shock some of you or shock the audience as well. But Rob, we'll go with you. We'll go the other way around here. Rob, what were your thoughts on the United States and the Netherlands?
Well, I mean, the British TV, they were very, very, very praising of Van Gaal's setup. And I think it was brilliant. I think it was brilliant, the job he did on the US. You know, it was a 3-4-2-1 Holland played. But the, sorry, a 3-4-1-2. They had very high, wide, what we might call inside forwards or wingers. They had Gakpo and Depay. And then they had Davy Klaassen was playing like a number 10. So basically you've got like a triangle turned upside down. And it created the perfect funnel. So every time the US centre backs had the ball, the wide forwards would show inside. And then you've got Klaassen plus a line of four behind. So they've got five midfielders against the US. And the US play quite a narrow three in the middle. So all the time, Holland had two people waiting. So they couldn't play in. There were times you were looking at the centre backs and they didn't have a clue where to go with the ball. The setup defensively from Holland was absolutely perfect, I thought. You know, it was, I've never really been a fan of that formation before, but England actually started to do it against Senegal last night. They had Foden and Saka very high and Kane almost dropped in at the base of the triangle. And that is when they started to tear Senegal apart. So I thought the setup from Holland was fantastic. And I think although the USA had a lot more possession, probably got through more passes. I may be wrong there. I think it was actually a victory really for Van Gaal. I was a bit disappointed with Berhalter because he keeps changing the personnel, but there was no attempt to change the system. You know, he's tried Sargent through the middle. He's tried Wright through the middle. He tried Ferreira through the middle, all to no effect. And it was, you know, it was 2-0 half time, wasn't it? Yes. 2-0?
They gave up a lead 2-0 at half time. Remaining seconds, literally.
And I think Van Gaal got a little bit lazy. He made two subs at half time. And I think Holland lost a little bit of concentration, a little bit of cohesion. But I thought there's an opportunity for Berhalter to just try something new. I think at half time they looked like they were out. But it was 4-3-3. He kept changing the players. And nothing changed in the second half for me. And I think Van Gaal had him pinned from after 10, 15 minutes. After the first goal, I think he had Berhalter in a chokehold. And there wasn't any attempt to... It was 4-3-3 from minute one. And I was a little bit disappointed in that because I couldn't see how USA were going to win the way the two teams were set up. I couldn't see it. And, you know, I felt a bit sorry for Ferreira. Talk about a brutal introduction to the World Cup. You know, up against Van Dijk and Ake, he didn't get a kick and then he's hauled off. But I'm not sure who in that system playing up front would have fared any better.
Well, there's an answer to that. There aren't any.
Yeah.
There aren't any. That this has been the constant point brought up by the pundits, professionals, coaches, all you know, who are watching the games and assessing the game. The United States of America does not have a number nine, someone who strikes fear in the hearts of defenders when he has the ball. So Berhalter is doing it by committee. I guess you have no other choice. You do it by committee. Mm-hmm. I think Jesus Ferreira, I don't know if he was a good call, because as we all know, he plays more of a false number nine. He dips into the midfield. And so he's not going to be that guy that's going to wreak some havoc deeper up, you know, facing two center backs, because he sits deeper. So it's almost like they're playing a 4-4-2 when he dips back as a false number nine into the midfield, and then you lose that. And he was only given a half. Now, I don't know if he knew that or not. I don't know if Berhalter says, hey, look, pal, you got a half. You do something, you stay. You don't, you're out. And well, at halftime, he was gone. Rob, did you see this one, my friend? Tell me you saw this one. Oh, excuse me, Paul. My bad. Paul, did you see this one?
I did watch this one.
There you go, my friend. There you go.
So I think Rob touched on this already about Louis van Gaal's setup and the tactics used, and talking about the wide forwards showing America inside, and America kept with insisting on trying to play through the centre and just kept probing and probing and waiting for a gap to open. Which it rarely did, and when it did open up, like, it just sort of got snuffed out, really. And, you know, didn't try anything new. And typically in like year 3-4-1-2, which sort of often became a 5-3-2. The spaces like often down the sides, and they didn't look to try to get down the sides, and they didn't look to move the ball, you know, and move that defense around. And when England used like a 5-3-2 previously, they struggled in the midfield because they didn't have enough width to like move from side to side, and that's how gaps appeared. But like, Netherlands never had to move because the USA were quite content to just try and keep forcing it mostly down the centre, and if it ended up on a side, they'd keep it on that side. You know, they were just like knocking against the door and not getting an answer, and still kept doing it, which was a little bit disappointing. Another thing to mention about the Holland team as well against them was just how fluid their system was. Although it was like 3-4-1-2 on paper, there was times when it became a 4-4-2 and a 4-diamond-2 and 4-3-3, and it just kept changing. You know, even Van Dijk would follow your like false nine into the midfield area, and then the wing backs would just tuck in and make it a back four, which isn't something you're used to seeing Van Dijk doing. You know, he tends not to go into that central midfield role. When he plays for Liverpool, he's got players in front of him who do that, and he stays sort of as that centre-back as the one at the back. So, yeah, like it was as close to total football and the ghost of Johan Cruyff as what we've probably seen for many number of years. Yeah, I thought that was really interesting to see that.
Before I pass it on to Marcus, you know, again, some of the things that jump out, and rather significantly in that particular match, you know, total passes. The United States had 567 total passes to 396 to the Netherlands. They outpossessed them, The pass completion rate, again, almost 90%. 105 line breaks to the Netherlands, 85. Defensive line break, 17 to the Netherlands, 7. That jumped out at me when you have the ability to break that last, well, next to the, I always say the goalkeeper is the last line of defense, being the goalkeeping guy. But nonetheless, you break it down 17 times. Receptions in the final third, getting the ball in the final third 135 times to 97. And the list goes on and on here, you know, relative to, you know, statistically what happened in the United States. On paper, we don't play the game on paper, but on paper, the United States did very, very well here. Marcus, your thoughts on that particular match?
Well, I would say that Louis van Gaal is one of the best coaches of all time, probably, especially tactical. He's a great tactical coach. I've had the pleasure of working closely to people who has worked for him. And you know that, I think this happened during the game that, I think Rob alluded to this, Paul kind of as well, but the Netherlands knew more or less what the U.S. would do. And they were very good at closing down the backs, and they forced the center backs to have the ball and took out the options, took out the passing options. So that was not a big shock. I think, I actually texted Greg Beerholter before the game, or like after the Iran game. I said, I'm looking forward to see you coach against Van Gaal's ego. Because remember when he was coaching in Manchester United, brought him down was not the tactics individually in the game, but it was his ego, his belief that his way would work. And he is very stubborn. And we know this. So I think Rob alluded to this, that you saw his ego at halftime because it changes. You saw him and his ego at halftime. And that was a chance where you can just kill that game and probably got back into it. Maybe the Ferreira thing and playing kind of as a false number nine was Greg's way of trying to innovate and surprise a little bit, potentially. I think it was a poor choice because, first of all, the strikers of the U.S. is not a threat. I think the Netherlands do not look at either of them as a threat specifically. And to Paul's note in terms of Van Dijk following a false number nine, it's like you say, it doesn't do it in Liverpool, but all Van Gaal's teams, they always follow the false number nine, happens every time. So I think there was kind of no shocks from the Holland thing. I think the US would have been well advised to do something differently. I don't know exactly what that should have done, should have been, right? Because if you look at Holland, it's not that easy because they are tactically very solid, obviously a good team, but something else would have been very, very smart. I think Rob talked about this, especially in like, do something that's different. And I think that's where we kind of failed this game. Like you said, it doesn't matter who you put on the field, doesn't matter who you take off. At the end of the day, if there are no passing options, if there are no spaces available that will actually threaten, then you will not win the game.
You know, Van Gaal is taking a bit of heat in the Dutch press because, as you noted very well there, Marcus, the style of play is boring. You know, and it's always an interesting, discussion in soccer or football that you must somehow play beautifully. You know, and I always use the word, you know, pragmatism. Pragmatism does not reek of beauty. But pragmatism is what's going to get you results. And Louis van Gaal is a pragmatist. You play pragmatically. You do what you need to do to get results. So go ahead, Marcus.
I mean, do you remember Brazil 2014, the World Cup?
Sure.
This is exactly how it looked. Different players, yep. Same formation. 3-4-1-2, many games, and 5-3-2, some games. But it was the same stuff, same stuff. And that brought him to a third place. He himself has said that he thinks this team is better. I don't agree. but I do think they will make it through. I do think they will beat Argentina. Then I think they'll get their faces smashed by Brazil, but we'll see.
Renato, what do you think?
I think that if Pulisic scores in the 7th minute, I would be curious to see if Van Gaal was going to do what he did, ended up doing, which is sit back 11 people in his own half. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. Maybe if Pulisic scores at the 7th minute mark, he panics a little bit and goes, wait a minute now. This is not what we had planned. But when they did go up after 10 minutes, it only cemented the idea of, okay, we really can do this now because this young team is going to, you know, they're going to do what they do best, which is, you know, use their midfielders and attack what, you know, they're going to just do what they do best. And I think that early goal, the non-goal by Pulisic allowed Holland to really say, okay, let's just sit and wait for these guys because we kind of know how they're coming. They're in a way, they're a one-trick pony. They've done it well, but they're a one-trick pony that maybe they don't have the options. We're sitting here talking about they should have done something different. And that is true. My question is, with whom? I mean, there's a reason why the three midfielders never got subbed out of all three games. Because there wasn't options that he felt maybe were viable options. Although I disagree. I think Reyna could have helped us. So maybe you're just sitting there going, let's just dance with the people that brought us there. And option B is nowhere near as strong as option A, even if it's a tired option A, even if it's an option A that they know is coming. And I thought in the first half, with the exception of a couple of glaring, you know, errors, you know, not tracking runners, things of that nature, I thought the United States played much better than I anticipated against a very good Dutch team. Having said that, I think that game, hopefully, makes Brian McBride and Ernie Stewart ask themselves, is this the guy to go forward? Because we have a young team now, but as you guys know, these guys are now, they're 23. They're going to be 26, 27, 28, some of them. That's a different footballer. Do you need an older voice that has the wisdom of saying, okay, how do we counterpunch? And how do I take an imperfect sub and give us a solid plan B based on the score, based on what I see the other team is doing? So that's going to be a very interesting decision that we're going to see play out. Does the United States keep Berhalter? Because I'm going to be honest with you, a year ago today, I had no faith whatsoever that the United States was even going to qualify. And Giovanni, you heard me say that when we, in our coffee session, I just don't think they were anywhere near what they are today. So you have to give Berhalter the credit that he's brought them to this place. I think the Holland game may have exposed his limitations, but how much of those limitations are based on maybe the options that the coaching staff knows they have at their disposition? Holland, they took their chances very well. They knew a young team was going to come at them in fifth gear the entire game, and Van Gaal and all his coaching experience knows how to counter that. My guess is Van Gaal rules that locker room with an iron fist. And if you don't know, don't do exactly what I say, I'll find someone else to do it. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But I think, and I don't mean this as a knock on our coach, I think we got out coached when the game had to change. And as you guys have said, we didn't change. But I ask myself, okay, other than Gio Reyna, what options could they bring in that maybe changed it up a bit? Obviously, we didn't have Sargent. I think even though Haji Wright scored a goal, I think he's limited. Ferreira proved he couldn't play. So I liked what I saw, although I think there should have been changes in the second half, because I think the game became a chess match that I don't think we responded as well as we should have.
You know, I play devil's advocate just a little bit here relative to Berhalter. And we, you touched upon it in your answer there, Renato, that being depth. We kept, I guess, collectively, we were asking, well, who do you put in, particularly the number nine position? There's ain't nobody. We all know when you're coaching and you're looking at your roster, and you say you have, in this case, the United States team, they've got 26 players, and you go, well, okay, there's 14. There's 14 that can play. There's 14 that can kind of get us where we need to go. After that, it drops. And if you take player A off, you put player B on, and the standard drops, that affects a match. And I, like you, Renato, I was very harsh on Berhalter until I kind of looked at the roster and looked at the youth, and I go, well, this is the hand he was dealt. So how does he play the hand? How does he play the hand? Well, obviously, in retrospect now, it's easy now in retrospect looking back, he played it pretty well because he got us into the round of 16 and, you know, got us to qualify and all that type of thing. With a very limited hand, and that hand was very young. This was like a group of, you know, college freshmen taking a graduate course against the Netherlands. And there he was, got him there. I'll give him that credit, which takes me to my next question. I'll ask you, Renato, because you've been there as part of the U.S. Men's National Team program. Do they keep him or do they go someplace else? And by association, if you go someplace else, is it an American? Is it Jesse Marsh's time? Is it Jim Curtin's time, or is it someone else outside the United States of America? What are your thoughts as a guy who was in there, in the mix back in 94?
I think they have to ask themselves, okay, if we change, who's available and what are we changing them for? If you don't have an answer to that, then maybe keeping him is the best alternative. In my opinion, I think they need to bring someone that has a little bit more wisdom, that has been around the block a little bit more, so that can recognize when a change needs to be made. I'm not saying that Berhalter is not a good coach. I just think that this group of talent needs maybe an older voice moving forward. And by older, I mean a voice that's been around the block a little bit more. And so when U.S. soccer gets together, they have to ask themselves, okay, if we change, what are we changing to? And if the model of what we're looking for, okay, we're looking for these qualities. Okay. Who exists that has those qualities? A, that might be available. B, okay. In 94, the United States brought in Bora Milutinovic, and they brought Bora in because he was the exact opposite of Bobby Gansler. Bobby Gansler was a very good coach, but it was very, this is the way we need to do things. And you show up to practice and everything needs to be perfect and everything is by, you know, very semi-strict person. Bora was the exact opposite and the players loved him. But also, Bora coached in World Cups. He knew what to expect. So they brought someone with a little bit of savvy. Trust me that by the end of the 4 years, the players were looking forward to go back to a more structured environment. You know, they were looking for, please give us more structure. So I think they have to ask themselves, if we're going to make a change, who's available? You know, is a Peter Vermes someone who's been around the block and has coached a really long time? And Peter's 60, he's going to be 60, but he's been in multiple World Cups. He's coached in MLS. Someone like that is, you know, I would lean toward Peter before I would lean toward Jesse Marsh. I think coaching in the World Cup is an acquired skill. I think there are things that happen at the World Cup that don't happen in the Champions League. And I don't mean to say it's better or worse. It's just a different environment. And I think if you're going to bring somebody new, you need to bring someone who has been to a World Cup and understands the nature of, hey, this is a very intense 10-day bubble. It's in a very intense 14-day bubble. Then it becomes a 21-day bubble, and we need to know how to adjust on the fly, because we never know who we're going to play next once we get out of the group stage. So I think that's a question the United States has to ask themselves.
I'm going to stick with you, Renato, again, because you've been there. And this is a touchy subject here in the United States. And the rest of you guys can share with us if it's indeed a touchy subject from where you folks are from. Do you bring in a foreign coach? Do we now, you know, the big thing before Berhalter was hired, we need to bring an American coach. We're at a point now where we're producing quality American coaches. And they did. They went with Greg Berhalter, and, you know, he now has a record that he can stand on. Do we bring in a foreign coach, or do we still stay with the American mindset that we have enough quality American coaches to be the next guy? Renato.
Here's where I think sometimes we've made a mistake, and we have three people from outside the country. There are still enormous pockets of football in the world that don't realize what the United States is and isn't when it comes to soccer. Okay. I have a player on my team. He's 24 years old. He's from England. And when I took him to I took him to a strength and conditioning facility the other day, and he goes, "We don't have anything like this in London or in the greater England area." So if you bring in the wrong foreign coach who has this, you're in big trouble. You bring in someone like a Jurgen Klopp, who has a very wide perspective of football and understands a lot of different cultures. That's okay. If you bring in the right foreign coach, it's okay. I think you just need to bring in a foreign coach that has a wide perspective, that understands American. Now look, there's a reason why Carlos Queiroz stays in the Middle East, or he stays in these smaller countries. He understands those countries. There's a reason why the French coach who's with the Saudis, yeah, he's with African nation. He understands those cultures, and he's good at those cultures. So if we're going to bring in a foreign coach, it better be a Jurgen Klopp type person that has a very open-minded perspective on culture, understands an American culture. It's not better or worse, but understands it. I'm not closed-minded to bringing a foreign coach. I want to bring in the right foreign coach. Do I think an American coach can do the job? A Peter Vermes, for argument's sake? Yes. You just have to bring in the right person that understands that soccer in America is only going to be as intensely important for a much shorter time than it is if you're the coach of Germany, or if you're the coach at Liverpool, where it's kind of like coaching the Yankees or the Red Sox, where every inning and every game is life and death to everybody around you. Bora understood that when he was here in 94. There's been a lot of foreign coaches that have come to MLS that have failed miserably. Brilliant coaches that went on to go back to Europe and were successful, but for whatever reason came here and just didn't adapt to the environment. So again, if you're going to bring in a foreign coach, it has to be the right foreign coach. But I think the number one factor is you need to bring in someone with World Cup experience, whether that's an American or whether that's a foreigner.
Yeah, that's going to be the interesting thing going forward. There's a bit of a counter argument, so to speak, that I hear from other pundits that, you know, Berhalter was there with these young guys, let him grow with these young guys. I don't know if I buy into that mentality. Typically, World Cup managers are hired through one cycle, and then you bring another guy for another cycle. Sometimes they come back. Kirosh is a prime example of that. This is going to be very interesting to see what the United States does in terms of if they don't bring Berhalter back, who do they bring back? So I want to kind of end here this episode of the GP Soccer Podcast World Cup Show. I would be remiss if I didn't talk about England, France with my two English friends here with Rob and Paul. This is going to be one of the classic showdowns. France is looking very daunting. Kylian Mbappe is, I mean, arguably one of the best players, if not the best player in the world right now, at only 24 years old. Your thoughts as English coaches, English experts, English fans, relative to this match coming up against the very powerful France? Rob, we'll start with you. Go ahead, Rob.
I mean, there's two things. I don't know if we're going to do predictions. I won't spoil it if we are. So my first thought is, and listen, I mean, okay, I couldn't sit here and pretend to know every player in the World Cup. And, you know, that's ridiculous. I try to watch as much football as I can. Obviously, I see more of the more established countries, the ones that we all know, However, I do stand by this opinion that England have the strongest roster of players in the World Cup. I really do believe that. And the reason I'm saying it, even if you look at perhaps the red hot favourites, you might say a Brazil, I'm just going to draw a couple of points. I know international football is different to domestic football and players thrive in different environments. You know, for example, you know, John Barnes, great English winger, fantastic club career, but the international scene, people never really took to him. Maybe slightly unfairly so. But if you look at Brazil, you've got Richarlison, who's a very good player, very good player. He doesn't get in Tottenham's team in their first choice 11, in my opinion. Now, I'm an Arsenal fan, so I don't need to say too much of what I think of Tottenham's general quality, but I do have to admit they have improved in recent years. You also have Fred in the squad competing for a shirt. I don't think Fred would be anywhere near England's squad. They're two examples. The French squad, I don't think Giroud would be anywhere near England's squad. Now, Richarlison and Giroud are very good players, they're very effective players. Player for player, and this is not me. I am not hugely patriotic. I'm more interested in my club rather than country. I'm a huge Arsenal fan. I follow England, but you know, I'm not talking with my heart here. When I look at that England squad, I can't see a weak player. I think the attacking options are off the scale. And you look at them, I think every attacking player has scored. Some of them multiple. It's scored 13 goals. Rashford scored, Foden scored, Grealish has scored, Saka scored, Kane scored, and they will carry on creating so many chances. So I think on paper, England are a stronger team, but that doesn't mean I think they're going to win. Are we going to do predictions, Giovanni? Because I'm desperately holding
if I'm limiting it to you and Paul, because you're my resident English folks here, we know where you're going to go. I mean, I'd like to think. You're not going to call France on this one, are you? You're going to go on record here with a worldwide audience and say France is going to beat your England? Is you can if you want, you can.
I try to be a brave man, but no, I do. I think France are going to win. Yeah, I think England have better players, 1 to 11, but I just have a feeling France are going to undo them.
You heard it here first. Well, Paul. Your compatriot over there has gone with France. What are your thoughts on the upcoming match with France?
It looks very interesting, especially based on how they've both played in the most recent game. And you know, like the tactics and maybe even some of the personnel might change in the next game based on what they've seen. But you try and like visualize what it might look like and where you think we might have a bit of an advantage. And on balance, it's very difficult to say. Like I talked earlier about how Netherlands were very fluent, and France is another team that were very fluent, and lots of different changes to the shape throughout the game. England changed a little bit, but not so much. But then again, do you not change because you don't need to? Like, we had a run of the play and we pretty much controlled the game after we scored the first goal. France will be different, but the tactics that we used to get around Senegal, where we sort of switched to like a back three and we could get out around the side because we created a bigger sort of distance and between their winger pressing Walker, and then so he had a little bit more space and time on the ball. He was then able to find the passes into midfield. Based on France's out possession shape, they were pretty much like 4-4 diamond two for most of it. So they're going to block off that centre and fight that pass out wide, presumably to Walker. But then he's not going to have the passes inside that he found in game Senegal. He's going to have to get forward down the field. And then do you really trust Stones and Maguire at the back on their own, tucking in behind him? Especially if Mbappe gets a run on him, because I think Walker will struggle with Mbappe's pace. So that's one prediction, like going in that direction. But then again, at the other end, you know, Rob's just mentioned about the surplus of attacking talent that we have and how many chances we've created. And you think there's some chances in us. So I think it's going to be a very competitive game. I think Rob's alluded a lot to the British mentality where we always feel like there's someone better out there. Even when we get a good result and we think we've got one hand on the trophy and we start singing it's coming home, the next time we come up against a good team, we think, oh, we've done it against the lesser teams. Can we do it against the better teams? And we start to doubt ourselves and we think, like, they've got world-class players that you know, the likes that we don't possess it. And it's always that sort of double-edged sword that we've got. But I'm going to go with my heart and think England's going to win against France 2-1. I'm going to be bold and put a score in it.
You're going to give us a score as well. Well, we'll when we gather again next week, we'll find out, you know, how this all sorts itself out. So ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. Rob Ellis, Paul Robinson, Renato Capobianco, Marcus Walbertson, my wonderful group of experts here. We talk all things World Cup. As you now know, each show comes out new each Wednesday. So we'll be up again each and every Wednesday talking about all things World Cup right up until the final in a couple of weeks' time. I'm Giovanni Piccini. This is the GP Soccer Podcast World Cup show. We're going to break for a commercial. And then on the other side, we have the GP Soccer Podcast World Cup news and analysis. Don't you dare go anywhere, because if you do, you know what happens. I will hunt you down.
Hey, this is TZ Layton, author of The Academy. You're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast with your host, Giovanni Piccini.
Hey, this is Giovanni Piccini. You all know me as a soccer coach and a clinician, but did you know that I'm a professional voiceover artist as well? I own and operate GP voiceover services, and my voice has been heard on radio, television, and over a variety of media platforms. Anywhere a voice is needed to tell your story, promote your organization, or bring words to life, GP Voiceover Services is your choice. I have a background in radio, have appeared in professional video productions, as well as having hosted cable television programs. I will work with you before your production to understand your preferences and plan just the right approach for your project. I also offer private consulting and training for those interested in exploring the voiceover profession. To learn more about GP Voiceover Services, visit my website at gpvoiceoverservices.com or email me at GP4Voiceover, and that's the number 4, at gmail.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Bucciarelli, the owner of Speed Training and Soccer Fitness and the Director of Sports Science with the National Soccer Coaches Association of Canada, and you're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast with your host, Giovanni Piccini.
This
is the GP Soccer Podcast World Cup News and Analysis. Brazilian soccer great Pelé was hospitalized in Sao Paulo to regulate the medication in his fight against a colon tumor. Pelé's daughter, Kelly Nascimento, added there was no emergency concerning her 82-year-old father's health. Hospital Albert Einstein in Sao Paulo later added in a statement that Edson Arantes do Nascimento, globally better known as Pelé, was in stable condition after having arrived Tuesday for reevaluation of the chemotherapeutic treatment of the tumor. The hospital also said the former footballer has full control of his vital functions. It was not taken to intensive or semi-intensive unit cares units for treatment. FIFA official Arsene Wenger took a shot at World Cup teams who tried to make political statements in Qatar, saying they lacked focus for their first games. Wenger said teams who had a good opening game were mentally ready to focus on competition and not on political demonstration. The former Arsenal manager did not specify which teams he was talking about while speaking during an analysis group of games at a FIFA-hosted event as the chief of global football development. Denmark and Germany both underperformed in their first games. The Danes drew 0-0 with Tunisia, and the Germans lost to Japan 2-1. They were among seven European soccer federations at the World Cup who wanted their captains to wear an armband as part of the Dutch diversity and anti-discrimination campaign to expose the host nation's poor human rights record. However, Wenger overlooked the part FIFA played in the dispute by avoiding the issue before teams arrived at the World Cup, then, seemingly under pressure from Qatari authorities, letting it spill into November 21st, hours before England and the Netherlands played their first games. Locally, the United States men's soccer team interest run through the group stage and into the knockout round of the World Cup resonated with television viewers, and ratings indicate Boston is among the most compelled markets. Boston wasn't a top five market in ratings or viewership for the U.S. team's opener against Wales, which averaged 7.79 million viewers on Fox. But the 0-0 draw with England was the most watched men's soccer match on U.S. English language television ever, averaging 15.38 million viewers. That surpassed the 1994 World Cup final between Italy and Brazil, which drew 14.5 million, but it must be noted that the out-of-home viewership, such as fans watching at bars and restaurants, wasn't included then. With an 8.0 rating and a 25 share for the U.S.-England match, Boston tied Dallas for third place among all markets, trailing only Kansas City and Hartford. It was much the same for the must-win match against Iran on that Tuesday afternoon. In the Americans' 1-0 victory, Boston again was the number three market with a 7.8 rating and a 30 share. Only Washington and Providence rated higher. Poland coach Czesław Miśniewicz isn't a fan of the upcoming changes that will see 48 teams in the 2026 World Cup with a different group format, even though it will give his country more chances to succeed at soccer's biggest tournament. "I think sometimes this can spoil the show," Miśniewicz said through a translator one day before his team faced the defending world champion France in the round of 16. "Sometimes less means more, and the more teams there are, the easier it will be to go through." Will this be an attractive for fans? In 2017, the FIFA Council added on a format with 16 groups of three teams playing each other once. The top two finishes in the three-team standings will advance to a round of 32. Officials have this year floated a change to 12 four-team groups. "I would prefer to have fewer teams. It would be more difficult to qualify, but it will be easier for the fans. We see that today that there are a great many matches, and if you want to see them all, then it's a huge problem." So there you go, folks, a little bit of news from the World Cup. Offer a little bit of analysis here. And much of what I'm about to share with you is things you've heard from me, not just in these shows covering the World Cup, but in previous broadcasts on the GP Soccer Podcast regarding player development here in the United States and some of the things that I think require some significant change relative to how we develop players and coaches here in the United States. Obviously disappointing to see the United States, you know, bow out against the Netherlands by a 3-1 score. You know, when you look at the data and you do a deep dive as I have, You know, the United States on many of the important statistical areas, we're actually performed better than the Netherlands. Not the least of which is, you know, possession and breaking of lines and a number of other data points that go into each and every analysis of a match. The only statistic that it matters, and we all know this, is the scoreline. I mean, you can win being a, you know, putting it in air quotes there. You can win all of the other, you know, data and statistics and, you know, areas of the game. But at the end of the day, it's the scoreboard. It's the scoreboard. Who had more goals than the other team? But nonetheless, this was a very exciting young group of men, and the emphasis there is on the word young. This was the youngest collection of men to have represented the United States of America. They were the second youngest team in the tournament. Yet despite that youth, they came with terrific confidence, which was on full display in each and every match. There's a lot to look forward to here. The majority of the players that will participate, probably, in 2026, when the World Cup is hosted here in the United States, as well as Mexico and Canada, will all be under the age of 30. So they will have had 4 years at their disposal to improve their games and come back 4 years wiser, 4 years better, 4 years better prepared to deal with the World Cup. So there's a great deal to look forward to. This latest episode of the 2022 World Cup is just the most recent chapter, or the latest chapter, if you will, in the ongoing development, the ongoing saga, the ongoing story of this particular group of U.S. men's national team players. Lots to look forward to. The biggest question coming out of this right now is Coach Greg Berhalter. His contract is up, and now the question becomes, is he retained for this next cycle, or does U.S. soccer start to look elsewhere? Now, typically, coaches come in for one cycle. Now, sometimes there's a coach that'll come in for a cycle and drop out of a cycle and then come back. But typically, it's one cycle and you're out, and you look for the next coach to bring the team, to bring the country to the next level. The question now becomes, do we look domestically? Do we look at what we have in MLS? Do we look at some of American coaches maybe coaching overseas? Jesse Marsh comes to mind. Do we go back to a foreign coach? There's a lot of criteria, a lot of boxes that have to be checked, whether that's a domestic coach, an American coach who's coaching overseas, or a foreign coach. First and foremost, you got to have a person who's a little bit older, a little bit wiser, not just in the realm of soccer, but in life. Now, remember, we're talking about a group of very, very young men here, kids for the most part. So you're going to need someone in this next cycle who's a little bit older, a little bit more mature, a little bit wiser on the soccer field and in life in general. This person also has to have an understanding of the unique environment that is the United States soccer landscape. We are a different sporting landscape. We are, by association, a different soccer landscape compared to any other country in the world. We operate differently. We function differently. And this person, or the next person who overtakes the team, has to understand that. So, you know, the list is tight. The list is very, very tight to find the right person to lead this particular generation of American players to the next World Cup. Because these next 4 years, as I noted earlier, are super, super, super important. I think if U.S. soccer is wise, it will reach out to those who have some terrific experience relative to coaching in the World Cup, who know the U.S. soccer landscape, who know what this particular group of players might need. I would like to think that U.S. soccer would convene a worthy and wise group of individuals, get together for a day, get together for a weekend, hash it out, and through great conversation and thought and a thought process, come up with at least criteria as who the next coach should be. It's an important decision. For if these young men are to indeed make progress to 2026, it's got to be the right person overseeing all of that. Now remember, there's no qualification because the United States will be one of the hosts, so they don't go through the qualification process. So there'll be a lot of games and tournaments and friendlies that will take place, and it'll all be part of their development. It'll be interesting. It'll be very, very interesting. You know, as a fan, super disappointed. I was a big fan of this group. I really thought that they were going to come out and defeat the Netherlands. They lost the game on soccer 101, and that is defending. Track your runners, mark up the attacking players, certainly when they're in your defensive third or in the penalty area, and they failed on both those counts. And the Netherlands, being a wise and worthy, experienced team, they will take advantage of those mistakes, and they did, to the tune of 3-1. Disappointing, yes, but lots to look forward to going forward. So there you have it. That's our show for today. And many thanks again for my wonderful group of soccer analysts. We'll get together again next week to discuss the games that have taken place. So if you like what you heard today, please tell everyone. You can follow the GP Soccer Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, Linktree, and on my website at gpsoccerpodcast.com. This is your host, Giovanni Pacini, and I will catch you later.